His laughter subsided. Aragorn poked at the snail with the tip of his boot. "It's been so long since there were dragons on Vroengard. It must not have realized what you were, and thought to make an easy meal of me. That would have been a sorry death indeed, to end up as dinner for a snail."
"But memorable," said Saphira.
"But memorable," he agreed, feeling his mirth return.
"And what did I say is the first law of hunting, younglings?"
asked Gleda. Together, Aragorn and Saphira replied, "Do not stalk your prey until you are sure that it is prey."
"Very good," said Gleda.
Then Aragorn said, "Hopping grubs, shadow birds, and now giant snails. How could the spells cast within the battle have created them?"
"The riders, the dragons, and the Forsworn loosed an enormous amount of energy during the conflict. Much of it was bound in spells, but much of it was not. Those who lived to tell of it said that for a time the world went mad, and nothing they saw or heard could be trusted. Some of that energy must have settled on the ancestors of the grubs and the birds you saw today, and altered them. However, you are mistaken to include the snails among their ranks. The Snarlkli, as they are known, have always lived here on Vroengard. They were a favorite food of ours, of the dragons, for reasons I'm sure, Saphira, you understand."
She hummed and licked her chops.
"And not only is their flesh soft and tasty, but the shells are good for the digestion."
"If they're just ordinary animals, then why didn't my ward stop them?" asked Aragorn. "At the very least, I should have been warned of approaching danger."
"That," replied Gleda, "may be a result of the battle. Magic did not create the Snarlkli, but that does not mean they have remained unaffected by the forces that have wracked this place. We should not linger here any longer than necessary. Better we leave before whatever else is lurking on the island decides to test our mettle."
With Saphira's help, Aragorn cracked open the shell of the burnt snail, and by the glow of a red weirlight, cleaned the spineless carcass within, which was a messy, slimy exercise that left him covered in gore up to his elbows. Then Aragorn had Saphira bury the meat close to the bed of coals. Afterward, Saphira returned to the spot in the grass where she had been lying, curled up once again, and went to sleep. This time, Aragorn joined her. Carrying his blankets and the saddlebags, one of which contained Gleda's heart of hearts, he crawled under her wing and settled in the warm, dark nook between her neck and her body. And there he spent the rest of the night, thinking and dreaming. The following day was as grey and gloomy as the previous one. A light dusting of snow covered the sides of the mountains and the tops of the foothills, and the air had a chill that led Aragorn to believe it would snow again later that day. Tired as she was, Saphira did not stir until the sun was already a hand's breadth above the mountains. Aragorn was impatient, but he let her sleep. It was more important for her to recover from the flight to Vroengard than for them to get an early start. Once she was awake, Saphira dug up the snail carcass for him, and he cooked a large breakfast of snail. He was not sure what to call it. Snail bacon? Whatever the name for it, the strips of meat were delicious, and he ate more than he usually would. Saphira devoured what was left, and then they waited an hour, for it would not be wise to enter a fight with food in their stomachs. Finally, Aragorn rolled up his blankets and strapped the saddle back onto Saphira, and together with Gleda, they set off for the Rock of Cuthien. The Rock of Cuthien. The walk to the apple grove seemed shorter than it had the previous day. The gnarled trees were as ominous as ever, and Aragorn kept his hand on Brisinga the whole time they were in the thicket. As before, he and Sapphira stopped at the edge of the tangled clearing that fronted the Rock of Cuthien. A flock of crows was perched upon the rough crag of stone, and at the sight of Sapphira they rose cawing into the air, as ill an omen as Aragorn could imagine. For half an hour Aragorn stood fixed in place as he cast spell after spell, searching for any magic that could cause him, Sapphira, or Gleda harm. Woven throughout the clearing, the Rock of Cuthien, and so far as he could tell, the rest of the island, he found a daunting array of enchantments. Some of the spells embedded in the depths of the earth had such power that it felt as if a great river of energy was flowing beneath his feet. Others were small and seemingly innocuous, sometimes affecting only a single flower or a single branch of a tree. More than half of the enchantments were dormant. Because they lacked energy, no longer had an object upon which to act, or were waiting for a certain set of circumstances that had yet to arrive. And a number of the spells seemed to conflict, as if the riders, or whoever had cast them, had sought to modify or negate earlier pieces of magic. Aragorn was unable to determine the purpose of most of the spells. No record remained of the words used to cast them, only the structures of energy that the long-dead magicians had so carefully created. And those structures were difficult, if not impossible, to interpret. Gleda was of some help, as he was familiar with many of the older, larger pieces of magic that had been placed on Vroengard. But otherwise, Aragorn was forced to guess. Fortunately, even though he could not always figure out what a spell was supposed to do, he was often able to establish whether it would affect him, Sapphira, or Gleda. It was a complicated process that required complicated incantations, though, and it took him another hour to examine all the spells. What most worried him, and Gleda as well, were the spells that they might not have been able to detect. Ferreting out other magicians' enchantments grew vastly more difficult if they had tried to hide their work. At last, when Aragorn was as confident as he could be that there were no traps on or around the Rock of Cuthien, he and Sapphira walked across the clearing to the base of the jagged, lichen-covered spire. Aragorn tilted his head back and looked toward the top of the formation. It seemed incredibly far away. He saw nothing unusual about the stone, nor did Sapphira.
"Let us say our names and be done with it," she said.
Aragorn sent a questioning thought to Gleda, and the dragon responded,
"She is right. There is no reason to delay. Speak your name, and Sapphira and I shall do likewise."
Feeling nervous, Aragorn clenched his hands twice, then unslung his shield from his back, drew Brisinger, and dropped into a crouch. "My name," he said in a loud, clear voice, "is Aragorn Shadeslayer, son of Brom."
"My name is Sapphira Bjartskula, daughter of Vavada. And mine, Gleda Eldunari, son of Nithring, she of the long tail."
They waited. Off in the distance, the crows cawed as if mocking them. Unease stirred within Aragorn, but he ignored it. He had not really expected opening the vault to be quite so simple.
"Try again, but this time say your piece in the ancient language," advised Gleda.
So Aragorn said, "Nam iet Aragorn Sundavar Vergandi, sonor aber Brom." And then Sapphira repeated her name and lineage in the ancient language, as did Gleda. Again, nothing happened. Aragorn's unease deepened. If their trip had been in vain. No, it did not bear thinking about, not yet. "Maybe all of our names have to be uttered out loud," he said.
"How?"
asked Sapphira.
"Am I supposed to roar at the stone? And what of Gleda?"
"I can say your names for you," said Aragorn.
"It seems unlikely that is what is required. But we may as well attempt it," said Gleda.
"In this or the ancient language?"
"The ancient language, I would think. But try both to be certain."
2 times, then, Aragorn recited their names. Yet the stone remained as stolid and unchanging as ever. Finally, frustrated, he said, "Maybe we're in the wrong place. Maybe the entrance to the Vault of Souls is on the other side of the stone. Or maybe it's on the very top."
"If that were the case, wouldn't the directions contained within Domia Aba Weirda have mentioned it?"
asked Glader. Aragorn lowered his shield. "When are riddles ever easy to understand?"
"What if you are only supposed to give your name?"
Saphira said to Aragorn.
"Did not Solimbum say, when all seems lost and your power is insufficient, go to the Rock of Cuthien and speak your name to open the Vault of Souls? Your name, Aragorn, not mine or Glader's."
Aragorn frowned. "It's possible, I suppose. But if only my name is needed, then perhaps I have to be by myself when I say it." With a growl, Saphira leaped into the air, ruffling Aragorn's hair and battering the plants in the clearing with the wind from her wings.
"Then try and be quick about it,"
she said as she flew east, away from the rock. When she was a quarter mile away, Aragorn looked back at the uneven surface of the rock, once more raised his shield, and once more pronounced his name, first in his own tongue and then in that of the elves. No door or passageway revealed itself. No cracks or fissures appeared within the stone. No symbols traced themselves upon its surface. In every respect, the towering spire seemed to be nothing more than a solid piece of granite, devoid of any secrets. "Saphira!" Aragorn shouted with his mind. Then he swore and stalked back and forth within the clearing, kicking at loose stones and branches. He returned to the base of the rock as Saphira swooped down to the clearing. The talons on her hind legs cut deep gouges in the soft earth as she landed, back-flapping to slow herself to a halt. Leaves and blades of grass swirled about her, as if caught in a whirlwind. Once she had dropped to all fours and folded her wings, Glader said,
"I take it you did not meet with success."
"No," snapped Aragorn, and he glared at the spire. The old dragon seemed to sigh.
"I was afraid this would be the case. There is only one explanation."
"That Solimbum lied to us? That he sent us off on a wild chase so that Galbatorix could destroy the Varden while we're gone?"
"No. That in order to open this Vault of Souls," said Saphira. "Yes, this vault he told you about. That in order to open it, we must speak our true names."
The words fell between them like weighty stones. For a time, none of them spoke. The thought intimidated Aragorn, and he was reluctant to address it, as if doing so would somehow make the situation worse.
"But if it's a trap," said Saphira.
"Then it is a most devilish trap,"
said Glader.
"The question you must decide is this. Do you trust Solimbum? For to proceed is to risk more than our lives. It is to risk our freedom. If you do trust him, can you be honest enough with yourselves to discover your true names, and quickly too? And are you willing to live with that knowledge, however unpleasant it might be? Because if not, then we should leave this very moment. I have changed since Oromus's death, but I know who I am. But do you, Saphira, do you, Aragorn, can you really tell me what it is that makes you the dragon and rider you are?"
Dismay crept through Aragorn as he gazed up at the Rock of Cuthien. "Who am I?" he wondered. And all the world a dream. Nasawada laughed as the starry sky spun around her and she fell tumbling toward a crevice of brilliant white light miles below. Wind tore at her hair, and her shift flapped wildly, the ragged ends of the sleeves snapping like whips. Great big bats, black and dripping, flocked about her, nipping at her wounds with teeth that cut and stabbed and burned like ice. And still she laughed. The crevice widened, and the light engulfed her, blinding her for a minute. When her eyes cleared, she found herself standing in the hall of the soothsayer, looking at herself, lying strapped to the ash-coloured slab. Next to her limp body stood Galbatorix, tall, broad-shouldered, with a shadow where his face ought to be, and a crown of crimson fire upon his head. He turned toward where she was standing, and extended a gloved hand.
"Come, Nasuwada, daughter of Arjahad, unbend your pride and pledge your fealty to me, and I shall give you everything you have ever wanted."
She uttered a derisive noise and lunged toward him with her hands outstretched. Before she could tear out his throat, the king vanished in a cloud of black mist. "What I want is to kill you!" she shouted toward the ceiling. The chamber rang with Galbatorix's voice as it emanated from every direction at once.
"Then here you shall stay until you realize the error of your ways."
Nasuwada opened her eyes. She was still on the slab, her wrists and ankles chained down, and the wounds from the burrow grub throbbing as if they had never stopped. She frowned. Had she been unconscious, or had she just been talking with the king? It was so difficult to tell when... In one corner of the chamber, she saw the tip of a thick green vine force its way between the painted tiles, cracking them. More vines appeared next to the first. They poked through the wall from the outside and spread across the floor, covering it in a sea of writhing, snake-like appendages. Watching them crawl toward her, Nasuwada began to chuckle. "Is this all he can think of? I have stranger dreams nearly every night." As if in response to her scorn, the slab beneath her melted into the floor, and the thrashing tendrils closed over her, wrapping around her limbs and holding them more securely than any chains. Her sight grew dark as the vines atop her multiplied, and the only thing she could hear was the sound of them sliding against one another, a dry, shifting sound, like that of falling sand. The air around her grew thick and hot, and she felt as if she was having trouble breathing. Had she not known that the vines were only an illusion, she might have panicked then. Instead, she spat into the darkness and cursed Galbatorix's name. Not for the first time, nor for the last, she was sure. But she refused to allow him the pleasure of knowing he had unbalanced her. Light. Golden sunbeams streaming across a series of rolling hills patched with fields and vineyards. She was standing by the edge of a small courtyard, underneath a trellis laden with blooming morning glories, the vines of which seemed uncomfortably familiar. She was wearing a beautiful yellow dress. There was a crystal goblet of wine in her right hand, and the musky cherry taste of wine upon her tongue. A slight breeze was blowing from the west. The air smelled of warmth and comfort, and freshly tilled land. "Ah, there you are," said a voice behind her, and she turned to see Murtagh striding toward her from a grand estate. Like her, he held a goblet of wine. He was dressed in black hose and a doublet of maroon satin trimmed with gold piping. A gem-encrusted dagger hung from his studded belt. His hair was longer than she remembered, and he appeared relaxed and confident in a way she had not seen before. That, and the light upon his face, made him appear strikingly handsome, noble even. He joined her under the trellis and placed a hand on her bare arm. The gesture seemed casual and intimate. "You minx, abandoning me to Lord Pharos and his interminable stories. It took me half an hour to escape." Then he paused and looked at her closer, and his expression became one of concern. "Are you feeling ill? Your cheeks look grey, She opened her mouth, but no words came to her. She could not think how to react. Murtagh's brow furrowed. You had another one of your attacks, didn't you? I don't know. I can't remember how I got here, or... She trailed off as she saw the pain that appeared in Murtagh's eyes, and which he quickly hid. He slid his hand down to the small of her back as he moved around her to stare out at the hilly landscape. With a swift motion, he drained his goblet. Then in a low voice, he said, I know how confusing this is for you. It isn't the first time this has happened, but... He took a deep breath and shook his head slightly. What is the last thing you remember? Tirm? Aberon? The Siege of Cythri? The gift I gave you that night in Aeam? A terrible sense of uncertainty overcame her. Urubane, she whispered. The Hall of the Soothsayer. That is my last memory. For an instant, she felt his hand tremble against her back. But his face betrayed no reaction. Urubane, he repeated hoarsely. He looked at her. Masawada, it's been 8 years since Urubane. No, she thought. It can't be. It can't be. And yet everything she saw and felt seemed so real. The motion of Murtagh's hair as the wind tousled it, the scent of the fields, the touch of her dress against her skin, it all seemed exactly as it should. But if she was actually there, then why hadn't Murtagh reassured her of it by reaching out to her mind as he had done before? Had he forgotten? If 8 years had elapsed, he might not remember the promise he made to her so long ago in the Hall of the Soothsayer. She started to say. And then she heard a woman call out, My lady! She looked over her shoulder and saw a portly maid hurrying down from the estate, the front of her white apron flapping. My lady, said the maid, and curtsied. I'm sorry to disturb you, but the children hoped that you would watch them put on their play for the guests. Children? She whispered. She looked back at Murtagh, to see his eyes shining with tears. Aye, he said. Children. 4 of them. All strong and healthy, and full of high spirits. She shuddered, overcome with emotion. She could not help it. Then she lifted her chin. Show me what I have forgotten. Show me why I have forgotten. Murtagh smiled at her with what seemed like pride. It would be my pleasure, he said, and kissed her on the forehead. He took her goblet and gave both glasses to the maid. Then he grasped her hands in his, closed his eyes, and bowed his head. An instant later, she felt a presence pressing against her mind, and then she knew. It was not him. It could never have been him. Angered by the deception, and by the loss of what could never be, she pulled her right hand free of Murtagh's, grabbed his dagger, and shoved the blade into his side. And she shouted, In El Harim there lived a man with yellow eyes. To me he said, Beware the whispers, for they whisper lies. Murtagh regarded her with a curiously blank expression, and then he faded away before her. Everything around her, the trellis, the courtyard, the estate, the hills with the vineyards, vanished, and she found herself floating in a void without light or sound. She tried to continue her litany, but no sound came from her throat. She could not even hear the pounding of her pulse in her veins. Then she felt the darkness twist, and... She stumbled and fell onto her hands and knees. Sharp rocks scraped her palms. Blinking as her eyes adjusted to the light, she rose to her feet and looked around. Ribbons of smoke drifting across a barren field similar to the burning plains. She was once more clothed in her tattered shift, and her feet were bare. Something roared behind her, and she spun around to see a 12-foot-tall cull charging toward her, swinging an iron-bound club as large as she was. Another roar came from her left, and she saw a second cull, as well as 4 smaller Urgals. Then a pair of cloaked, hunchbacked figures scurried out of the whitish haze and darted in her direction, chittering and waving their leaf-bladed swords. Although she had never seen them before, she knew they were the Razak. She laughed again. Now Galbatorix was just trying to punish her. Ignoring the oncoming enemies, whom she knew she would never be able to kill or escape, she sat cross-legged on the ground and began to hum an old dwarvish tune. Galbatorix's initial attempts to deceive her had been subtle affairs that might very well have succeeded in leading her astray had Murtagh not warned her beforehand. To keep Murtagh's help a secret, she had pretended to be ignorant of the fact that Galbatorix was manipulating her perception of reality. But regardless of what she saw or felt, she refused to allow the king to trick her into thinking of the things she should not, or far worse, giving him her loyalty. Defying him had not always been easy, but she held to her rituals of thought and speech, and with them she had been able to thwart the king. The first delusion had been of another woman, Rialla, who joined her in the hall of the soothsayer as a fellow prisoner. The woman claimed she was secretly wedded to one of the Varden's spies in Urubane, and that she had been captured while carrying a message for him. Over what seemed like the course of a week, Rialla tried to ingratiate herself with Nessawada, and in a sideways manner, convince her that the Varden's campaign was doomed, that their reasons for fighting were flawed, and that it was only right and proper to submit to Galbatorix's authority. In the beginning, Nessawada had not realized that Rialla herself was an illusion. She assumed that Galbatorix was distorting the woman's words or appearance, or perhaps that he was tampering with her own emotions to make her more susceptible to Rialla's arguments. As the days had dragged on, and Murtagh neither visited nor contacted her, she had grown to fear that he had abandoned her to Galbatorix's clutches. The thought caused her more anguish than she would have liked to admit, and she found herself worrying about it at nearly every turn. Then she had begun to wonder why Galbatorix had not come to torture her during the week. And it occurred to her that if a week had elapsed, then the Varden and the elves would have attacked Urubane. And if that had happened, Galbatorix surely would have mentioned it, if only to gloat. Moreover, Rialla's somewhat odd behavior, combined with a number of inexplicable gaps in her memory, Galbatorix's forbearance, and Murtagh's continued silence, for she could not bring herself to believe that he would break his word to her, convinced her, as outlandish as it seemed, that Rialla was an apparition, and that time was no longer what it seemed. It had shaken her to realize that Galbatorix could alter the number of days she thought had passed. She loathed the idea. Her sense of time had grown vague during her imprisonment, but she had retained a general awareness of its passage. To lose that, to become unmoored in time, meant she was even more at Galbatorix's mercy, for he could prolong or contract her experiences as he saw fit. Still, she remained determined to resist Galbatorix's attempts at coercion, no matter how much time seemed to go by. If she had to endure 100 years in her cell, then 100 years she would endure, when she had proven immune to Rialla's insidious whisperings, and indeed finally denounced the woman for being a coward and a traitor. The figment was taken from her chamber, and Galbatorix moved on to another ploy. Thereafter his deceptions had grown increasingly elaborate and improbable, but none broke the laws of reason, and none conflicted with what he had already shown her, for the king was still trying to keep her ignorant of his meddling. His efforts culminated when he seemed to take her from the chamber to a dungeon cell elsewhere in the citadel, where she saw what appeared to be Aragorn and Saphira bound in chains. Galbatorix had threatened to kill Aragorn unless she swore fealty to him, the king. When she refused, much to Galbatorix's displeasure, and, she thought, his surprise, Aragorn shouted a spell that somehow freed the three of them. After a brief duel, Galbatorix fled, which he doubted he ever would do in reality, and then she, Aragorn, and Saphira started to fight their way out of the citadel. It had been rather dashing and exciting, and she had been tempted to find out how the sequence of events would resolve itself. But by then, she felt she had played along with Galbatorix's false show for long enough. So she seized upon the first discrepancy she noticed, the shape of the scales around Saphira's eyes, and used it as an excuse to feign a realization that the world around her was only a pretense. "You promised you would not lie to me while I was in the hall of the soothsayer," she had shouted into the air. "What is this but a lie, oathbreaker?" Galbatorix's wrath at her discovery had been prodigious. She had heard a growl like that of a mountain-sized dragon, and then he abandoned all subtlety, and for the rest of the session he subjected her to a series of fantastical torments. At last, the apparitions had ceased, and Murtagh had contacted her to let her know she could once again trust her senses. She had never been so happy to feel the touch of his mind. That night he had come to her, and they spent hours sitting together and talking. He told her of the Vardens' progress, they were nearly upon the capital, and of the Empire's preparations, and he explained that he believed he had discovered a means of freeing her. When she pressed him for details, he refused to elaborate, saying, "I need another day or two to see if it will work. But there is a way, Nasawada. Take heart in that." She had taken heart in his earnestness and his concern for her. Even if she never escaped, she was glad to know that she was not alone in her captivity. After she recounted some of the things Galbatorix had done to her, and the means by which she had foiled him, Murtagh chuckled. "You've proven more of a challenge than he anticipated. It's been a long time since anyone has given him this much of a fight. I certainly didn't. I understand little about it, but I know it's incredibly difficult to create believable illusions. Any competent magician can make it seem as if you're floating in the sky, or that you're cold or hot, or that there's a flower growing in front of you. Small, complicated things, or large, simple things, are the most any one person can hope to create, and it requires a great deal of concentration to maintain the illusion. If your attention wavers, all of a sudden the flower has 4 petals instead of 10, or it might vanish altogether. Details are the hardest thing to replicate. Nature is filled with infinite details, but our minds can only hold so much. If you're ever in doubt as to whether what you're seeing is real, look at the details. Look for the seams in the world, where the spellcaster either does not know or has forgotten what should be there, or has taken a shortcut to conserve energy. If it's so difficult, then how does Galbatorix manage it? He's using the Eldonari. All of them? Murtagh nodded. They provide the energy and the details needed, and he directs them as he wants. So then, the things I see are built on the memories of dragons? She asked, feeling slightly awed. He nodded again. That and the memories of their riders, for those who had riders. The following morning, Murtagh had woken her with a swift bolt of thought to tell her that Galbatorix was about to start again. Thereafter, phantoms and illusions of every sort had beset her. But as the day wore on, she noticed that the visions, with a few notable exceptions, such as that of her and Murtagh at the estate, had grown increasingly fuzzy and simple, as if either Galbatorix or the Eldunari were growing tired. And now she sat upon the barren plain, humming a dwarven tune, as Kull, Urgles, and Razak bore down on her. They caught her, and it felt as if they beat and cut her, and at times she screamed and wished her pain would end. But not once did she consider giving in to Galbatorix's desires. Then the plane vanished, as did most of her suffering, and she reminded herself, "It is only in my mind. I shall not give in. I am not an animal. I am stronger than the weakness of my flesh." A dark cave, lit by glowing green mushrooms, appeared around her. For several minutes, she heard a large creature snuffling and padding about in the shadows between the stalagmites, and then she felt the creature's warm breath against the back of her neck. and she smelled the odour of carrion. She started to laugh again, and she continued to laugh, even as Galbatorix forced her to confront horror after horror in an attempt to find the particular combination of pain and fear that would break her. She laughed because she knew her will was stronger than his imagination, and she laughed because she knew she could count on Murtagh's help. And with him as her ally, she did not fear the spectral nightmares Galbatorix inflicted upon her, no matter how terrible they seemed at the time. A question of character. Aragorn's foot slipped out from under him as he stepped on a patch of slick mud, and he fell onto his side in the wet grass with brutal suddenness. He uttered a grunt and winced as his hip began to throb. The impact was sure to leave a bruise.
"Basil," he said, as he rolled to his feet and carefully stood.
"At least I didn't land on Brisinga," he thought, as he pried scales of cold mud from his leggings. Feeling glum, he resumed trudging toward the ruined building where they had decided to camp, in the belief it would be safer than by the forest. As he strode through the grass, he startled a number of bullfrogs, who sprang out of hiding and fled hopping to either side. The bullfrogs were the only other strange creature they had encountered on the island. Each had a horn-like projection above its reddish eyes, and from the center of its forehead sprouted a curving stalk, much like a fisherman's rod, upon the end of which hung a small, fleshy organ that at night glowed either white or yellow. The light allowed the bullfrogs to lure hundreds of flying insects within the reach of their tongues, and as a result of their easy access to food, the frogs grew enormously large. He had seen some the size of a bear's head, great fleshy lumps with staring eyes and mouths as wide as both his outstretched hands put together. The frogs reminded him of Angela the herbalist, and he suddenly wished that she were there on Vroengard Island with them. "If anyone could tell us our true names, I bet she could." For some reason, he always felt as if the herbalist could see right through him, as if she understood everything about him. It was a disconcerting sensation, but at the moment he would have welcomed it. He and Saphira had decided to trust Solombum and stay on Vroengard for another 3 days at most, while they tried to discover their true names. Gleda had left the decision up to them. He said,
"You know Solombum better than I do. Stay or do not. Either way, the risk is great. There are no more safe paths."
It was Saphira who ultimately made the choice.
"The Weircats would never serve Galbatorix," she said. "They prize their freedom too highly. I would trust their word before that of any other creature, even an elf."
So they had stayed. They had spent the rest of that day, and now most of the next, sitting, thinking, talking, sharing memories, examining each other's minds, and trying various combinations of words in the ancient language, all in the hope that they would be able to either consciously work out their true names, or if they were lucky, strike upon them by accident. Gleda had offered his help when asked, but for the most part he kept to himself, and gave Aragorn and Saphira privacy for their conversations, many of which Aragorn would have been embarrassed for anyone else to hear.
"The finding of one's true name ought to be something one does by oneself," said Gleda. "If I think of either of yours, I will tell you, for we have no time to waste. But it would be better if you discover them on your own."
As of yet, neither of them had succeeded. Ever since Brom had explained to him about true names, Aragorn had wanted to learn his own. Knowledge, particularly self-knowledge, was ever a useful thing, and he hoped his true name would allow him to better master his thoughts and feelings. Still, he could not help but feel a certain amount of trepidation about what he might discover. Assuming that he could discover his name in the next few days, of which he was not entirely sure, he hoped he could, both for the success of their mission, and because he did not want Gleda or Saphira to figure it out for him. If he was to hear his whole being described in a word or phrase, then he wanted to arrive at that knowledge on his own, instead of having it thrust upon him. Aragorn sighed as he climbed the 5 broken steps that led up to the building. The structure had been a nesting house, or so Gleda had said, and by the standards of Vroengard, it was so small as to be entirely unnoteworthy. Still, the walls were over 3 stories high, and the interior was large enough for Saphira to move about with ease. The southeastern corner had collapsed inward, taking part of the ceiling with it, but otherwise the building was sound. Aragorn's steps echoed as he walked through the vaulted entryway and made his way across the glassy floor of the main chamber. Embedded within the transparent material were swirling blades of color that formed an abstract design of dizzying complexity. Every time he looked at it, he felt as if the lines were about to resolve into a recognizable shape, but they never did. The surface of the floor was covered with a fine web of cracks that radiated outward from the rubble beneath the gaping hole where the walls had given way. Long tendrils of ivy hung from the edges of the broken ceiling, like lengths of knotted rope. Water dripped from the ends of the vines to fall into shallow, misshapen puddles, and the sound of the droplets striking echoed throughout the building, a constant, irregular beat that Aragorn thought would drive him mad if he had to listen to it for more than a few days. Against the north-facing wall was a half-circle of stones Saphira had dragged and pushed into place to protect their camp. When he reached the barrier, Aragorn jumped onto the nearest block, which stood over 6 feet tall. Then he dropped down to the other side, landing heavily. Saphira paused in the midst of licking her forefoot, and he felt a questioning thought from her. He shook his head, and she returned to her grooming. Undoing his cloak, Aragorn walked over to the fire he had built close to the wall. He spread the sodden garment on the floor, then removed his mud-caked boots, and set them out to dry as well.
"Does it look as if it will start raining again?"
Saphira asked. "Probably." He squatted by the fire for a bit, then sat on his bedroll and leaned against the wall. He watched Saphira as she worked her crimson tongue around the flexible cuticle at the base of each of her talons. An idea occurred to him, and he murmured a phrase in the ancient language, but to his disappointment, he felt no charge of energy in the words, nor did Saphira react to their utterance, as had Sloane when Aragorn had spoken his true name. Aragorn closed his eyes and tipped his head back. It frustrated him that he was unable to puzzle out Saphira's true name. He could accept that he did not fully understand himself, but he had known Saphira since the moment she had hatched, and he had shared nearly all of her memories. How could there be parts of her that were still a mystery to him? How could he have been better able to understand a murderer like Sloane than his own spell-bonded partner? Was it because she was a dragon and he was a human? Was it because Sloane's identity had been simpler than Saphira's? Aragorn did not know. One of the exercises he and Saphira had done, on Gleda's recommendation, was to tell each other all of the flaws they had noticed, he in her and she in him. It had been a humbling exercise. Gleda had also shared his observations, and though the dragon had been kind, Aragorn could not help but feel a sense of wounded pride upon hearing Gleda list his various failings. And that, too, Aragorn knew he needed to take into account when trying to discover his true name. For Saphira, the hardest thing to come to terms with had been her vanity, which she had refused to acknowledge as such for the longest time. For Aragorn, it had been the arrogance Gleda claimed he sometimes displayed. His feelings concerning the men he had killed, and all the petulance, selfishness, anger, and other shortcomings to which he, like so many others, was prey. And yet, though they had examined themselves as honestly as they could, their introspection had yielded no results. "Today and tomorrow, that's all we have." The thought of returning to the Varden empty-handed depressed him. "How are we supposed to best Calbatorix?" he wondered, as he had so many times before. "Another few days, and our lives may no longer be our own. We'll be slaves, like Murtagh and Thorn." he swore under his breath, and surreptitiously punched a fist against the floor.
"Be calm, Aragorn,"
said Gleda, and Aragorn noticed the dragon was shielding his thoughts so that Saphira did not hear.
"How can I?"
he growled.
"It is easy to be calm when there is nothing to worry about, Aragorn. The true test of your self-control, however, is whether you can remain calm in a trying situation. You cannot allow anger or frustration to cloud your thoughts, not at the moment. Right now, you need your mind to be clear."
"Have you always been able to remain calm at times like this?" The old dragon seemed to chuckle.
"No. I used to growl and bite and knock down trees and tear up the ground. Once I broke the top of a mountain in the spine. The other dragons were rather upset with me for that. But I have had many years to learn that losing my temper rarely helps. You have not, I know. But allow my experience to guide you in this. Let go of your worries and focus only on the task at hand. The future will be what it will, and fretting about it will only make your fears more likely to come true."
"I know," Aragorn sighed, "but it's not easy."
"Of course not. Few things of worth are."
Then Gleda withdrew and left him to the silence of his own mind. Aragorn fetched his bowl from the saddlebags, hopped over the half-circle of stones, and walked barefoot to one of the puddles underneath the opening in the ceiling. A light drizzle had begun to fall, coating that part of the floor with a slippery layer of water. He squatted by the edge of the puddle and began to scoop water into the bowl with his bare hands. Once the bowl was full, Aragorn retreated a few feet and set it on a piece of stone that was the height of a table. Then he fixed an image of Rohan in his mind and murmured, "Draumur Kopa." The water in the bowl shimmered, and an image of Rohan appeared against a pure white background. He was walking next to Horst and Albrecht. The three men looked tired and footsore, but they still carried weapons, so Aragorn knew the Empire had not captured them. He next scried Jormungandr, then Solumbum, who was tearing at a freshly killed robin, and then Arya, but Arya's wards hid her from his sight, and all he saw was blackness. At last Aragorn released the spell and tossed the water back into the puddle. As he climbed over the barrier surrounding their camp, Saphira stretched and yawned, arching her back like a cat, and said,
"How are they?"
"Safe, as far as I can tell." He dropped the bowl on the saddlebags, then lay on his bedroll, closed his eyes, and returned to scouring his mind for ideas as to what his true name might be. Every few minutes he thought of a different possibility, but none touched a chord within him, so he discarded them and began anew. All of the names contained a few constants: the fact that he was a rider, his affection for Saphira and Arya, his desire to vanquish Galbatorix, his relationships with Rohan, Garrow, and Brom, and the blood he shared with Murtagh. But no matter in what combination he placed those elements, the name did not speak to him. It was obvious that he was missing some crucial aspect of himself. So he kept making the names longer and longer, in the hope that he might stumble across whatever it was he was overlooking. When the names began to take him more than a minute to say, he realized he was wasting his time. He needed to re-examine his basic assumptions once again. He was convinced that his mistake lay in failing to notice some fault, or in not giving enough consideration to a fault he was already aware of. People, he had observed, were rarely willing to acknowledge their own imperfections, and he knew the same was true of himself. Somehow he had to cure himself of that blindness while he yet had time. It was a blindness born of pride and self-preservation, as it allowed him to believe the best of himself as he went about his life. However, he could no longer afford to indulge in such self-deception. Thus he thought and continued to think as the day wore on, but his efforts met only with failure. The rain grew heavier. Aragorn disliked the sound of it drumming against the puddles, for the featureless noise made it difficult to hear if anyone was trying to sneak up on them. Since their first night on Vroengard, he had seen no sign of the strange hooded figures whom he had watched wending their way through the city, nor had he felt any hint of their minds. Nevertheless, Aragorn remained conscious of their presence, and he could not help feeling that he and Saphira were about to be attacked at any moment. The grey light of day slowly faded to dusk, and a deep, starless night settled across the valley. Aragorn heaped more wood onto the fire. It was the only illumination within a nesting house, and the cluster of yellow flames was like a tiny candle within the huge echoing space. Close to the fire, the glassy floor reflected the glow of the burning branches. It gleamed like a sheet of polished ice, and the blades of color within often distracted Aragorn from his brooding. Aragorn ate no dinner. He was hungry, but he was too tense for food to sit well in his stomach, and in any case he felt that a meal would slow his thinking. Never was his mind so keen as when his belly was empty. He would not, he decided, eat again until he knew his true name, or until they had to leave the island, whichever came first. Several hours passed. They spoke little amongst themselves, although Aragorn remained conscious of the general drift of Saphira's moods and thoughts, even as she remained conscious of his. Then, as Aragorn was about to enter into his waking dreams, both to rest and out of hope that the dreams might provide some insight, Saphira uttered a yowl, reached forward with her right paw, and slapped it upon the floor. Several branches within the fire crumbled and fell apart, sending a burst of sparks toward the black ceiling. Alarmed, Aragorn sprang to his feet and drew Brisinger while he searched the darkness beyond the half-circle of stones for enemies. An instant later, he realized that Saphira's mood was not one of concern or anger, but of triumph.
"I have done it!"
exclaimed Saphira. She arched her neck and loosed a jet of blue and yellow flame into the upper reaches of the building.
"I know my true name!"
She spoke a single line in the ancient language, and the inside of Aragorn's mind seemed to ring with a sound like a bell, and for a moment the tips of Saphira's scales gleamed with an inner light, and she looked as if she were made of stars. The name was grand and majestic, but also tinged with sadness, for it named her as the last female of her kind. In the words, Aragorn could hear the love and devotion she felt for him, as well as all the other traits that made up her personality. Most he recognized, a few he did not. Her flaws were as prominent as her virtues, but overall, the impression was one of fire and beauty and grandeur. Saphira shivered from the tip of her nose to the tip of her tail, and she shuffled her wings.
"I know who I am,"
she said.
"Well done, Bjartskule,"
said Gleda, and Aragorn could sense how impressed he was.
"You have a name to be proud of. I would not say it again, however, not even to yourself, until we are at the spire we have come to see. You must take great care to keep your name hidden, now that you know it."
Saphira blinked and shuffled her wings again.
"Yes, master."
The excitement running through her was palpable. Aragorn sheathed Brisinger and walked over to her. She lowered her head until it was at his level. He stroked the line of her jaw and then pressed his forehead against her hard snout and held her as tightly as he could, her scales sharp against his fingers. Hot tears began to slide down his cheeks.
"Why do you cry?"
she asked. "Because I'm lucky enough to be bonded with you,"
little one.
They talked for a while longer, as Saphira was eager to discuss what she had learned about herself. Aragorn was happy to listen, but he could not help feeling a little bitter that he still had not been able to divine his own true name. Then Saphira curled up on her side of the half-circle and went to sleep, leaving Aragorn to ruminate by the light of the dying campfire. Glaedah remained awake and aware, and sometimes Aragorn consulted with him, but for the most part he kept to himself. The hours crawled past, and Aragorn grew increasingly frustrated. His time was running out. Ideally, he and Saphira should have left for the Varden the previous day. And yet no matter what he tried, he seemed unable to describe himself as he was. It was nearly midnight by his reckoning, when the rain ceased. Aragorn fidgeted, trying to make up his mind. Then he bounded to his feet, too wound up to bear sitting any longer. "I'm going for a walk," he said to Glaedah. He expected the dragon to object, but instead Glaedah said,
"Leave your weapons and armor here."
"Why?"
"Whatever you find, you need to face it by yourself. You cannot learn what you are made of if you rely on anyone or anything else to help you."
Glaedah's words made sense to Aragorn, but still he hesitated before he unbuckled his sword and dagger and pulled off his mail hauberk. He donned his boots and his damp cloak, and then he dragged the saddlebags that contained Glaedah's heart of hearts closer to Saphira. As Aragorn started to leave the half-circle of stones, Glaedah said,
"Do what you must, but be careful."
Outside the nesting house, Aragorn was pleased to see patches of stars and enough moonlight shining through the gaps in the clouds for him to make out his surroundings. He bounced on the balls of his feet a few times, wondering where to go. And then he set off at a brisk trot toward the heart of the ruined city. After a few seconds, his frustration got the better of him, and he increased his pace to an all-out run. As he listened to the sound of his breathing and of his footsteps pounding against the paving stones, he asked himself, "Who am I?" But no answer came to him. He ran until his lungs began to fail, and then he ran some more. And when neither his lungs nor his legs would sustain him any longer, he stopped by a weed-filled fountain and leaned on his arms against it while he recovered his breath. Around him loomed the shapes of several enormous buildings, shadowy hulks that looked like a range of ancient crumbling mountains. The fountain stood in the center of a vast square courtyard, much of which was littered with pieces of broken stone. He pushed himself off the fountain and slowly turned in a circle. In the distance, he could hear the deep, resonant croaking of the bullfrogs, an odd booming sound that grew especially loud whenever one of the larger frogs participated. A cracked slab of stone several yards away caught his eye. He walked over, grasped it by the edges, and with a heave, picked it off the ground. The muscles in his arms burning, he staggered to the edge of the courtyard and threw the slab onto the grass beyond. It landed with a soft but satisfying thump. He strode back to the fountain, unclasped his cloak, and draped it over the edge of the sculpture. Then he strode to the next piece of rubble, a jagged wedge that had cleaved off a larger block, and he fit his fingers underneath it and lifted it onto his shoulder. For over an hour, he labored to clear the courtyard. Some of the fallen masonry was so big he had to use magic to move it, but for the most part he was able to use his hands. He was methodical about it. He worked back and forth across the courtyard, and every piece of rubble he encountered, no matter how large or small, he stopped to remove. The effort soon left him drenched in sweat. He would have removed his tunic, but the edges of the stone were often sharp and would have cut him. As it was, he accumulated a host of bruises across his chest and shoulders, and he scraped his hands in numerous places. The exertion helped calm his mind, and since it required little thought, left him free to mull over all that he was and all that he might be. In the midst of his self-appointed task, as he was resting, after having shifted a particularly heavy length of cornice, he heard a threatening hiss, and he looked up to see a Snaldly, this one with a shell at least 6 feet tall, gliding out of the darkness with startling speed. The creature's boneless neck was fully extended. Its lipless mouth was like a slash of darkness splitting its soft flesh, and its bulbous eyes were pointed directly at him. By the light of the moon, the Snaldly's exposed flesh gleamed like silver, as did the track of slime it left behind. "Letter," said Aragorn, and he straightened upright and shook drops of blood from his torn hands. "Ono ac nia trea eom verens mal etha, o Snaldly." As he spoke his warning, the snail slowed and retracted its eyes several inches. It paused when it was a few yards away, hissed again, and began to circle around to his left. "Oh, no, you don't," he muttered, turning with it. He glanced over his shoulders to make sure no other Snaldly were approaching from behind. The giant snail seemed to realize that it could not catch him by surprise, for it stopped and sat hissing and waving its eyeballs at him. "You sound like a teapot left a boil," he said to it. The Snaldly's eyeballs waved even faster, and then it charged at him, the edges of its flat belly undulating. Aragorn waited until the last moment, then jumped to the side and let the Snaldly slide past. He laughed and slapped the back of its shell. "Not too bright, are you?" Dancing away from it, he began to taunt the creature in the ancient language, calling it all sorts of insulting but perfectly accurate names. The snail seemed to puff up with rage. Its neck thickened and bulged, and it opened its mouth even farther and began to sputter as well as hiss. Again and again it charged at Aragorn, and every time he jumped out of the way. At last, the Snaldly grew tired of the game. It withdrew a half dozen yards and sat staring at him with its fist-sized eyeballs. "How do you ever catch anything when you're so slow?" Aragorn asked in a mocking tone, and he stuck his tongue out at the snail. The Snaldly hissed once more, and then it turned around and slid off into the darkness. Aragorn waited several minutes to be sure it was gone, before he returned to clearing the rubble. "Maybe I should just call myself Snail Vanquisher," he muttered, as he rolled a section of a pillar across the courtyard. "Aragorn Shadeslayer, Vanquisher of Snails. I would strike fear into the hearts of men wherever I went." It was the deepest part of the night when he finally dropped the last piece of stone onto the border of grass that edged the courtyard. There he stood, panting. He was cold and hungry and tired, and the scrapes on his hands and wrists smarted. He had ended by the northeastern corner of the courtyard. To the north was an immense hall that had been mostly destroyed during the battle. All that remained standing was a portion of the back walls and a single ivy-coloured pillar where the entryway had been. He stared at the pillar for the longest time. Above it, a cluster of stars, red, blue, and white, shone through an opening in the clouds, gleaming like cut diamonds. He felt a strange attraction to them, as if their appearance signified something that he ought to be aware of. Without bothering to consider his action, he walked to the base of the pillar, scrambling over piles of rubble, then reached as high as he could and grasped the thickest part of the ivy, a stem as big around as his forearm and covered with thousands of tiny hairs. He tugged on the vine. It held, so he jumped off the ground and began to climb. Hand over hand, he scaled the pillar, which must have been 300 feet tall, but which felt taller the farther he got from the ground. He knew he was being reckless, but then he felt reckless. Halfway up, the smaller tendrils of vine began to peel off the stone when he put his full weight on them. After that, he was careful to only grab hold of the main stem and some of the thicker side branches. His grip had almost given out by the time he arrived at the top. The crown of the pillar was still intact. It formed a square, flat surface, large enough to sit on.